think I want to give everyone a great mazel tov on this human and this accomplishment. And we'll give you the chutz to make many more siyumim and finish Bavli, Rishalmi, and many more sfarim. So I know that you're going to have a big celebration at 7, so we're going to stop a minute before 7 or so you can set up everything. Absolutely, you can get an art scroll. This is exactly what the Gemara Megillah means. Remember, the Gemara Megillah says that Yonasan ben Uziel, the greatest of the Talmidim of Hillel, wrote a Targum on Nevi'im. That's Targum Yonasan. And then he began to write a Targum on Ksuvim. And then there was an earthquake in Eretz Yisrael where HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not let him do it because Mi Gila Lebanai Razeh, who is able to reveal the secrets? And the pshat is very simple, that in the Ksuvim, particularly the book of Daniel, there is a detailed calculation as to when Mashiach will come. There are formulas. There are actually 5 different dating systems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu used in communicating to Daniel when will be the Kates. Of course, even the Kates is not so kosher. Does Kates mean Mashiach? Does it mean Chiyas Amazim? Does it mean Binyan Beis Hamikdash? Even that exact Nakuda is not clear, but there are 5 different systems. And if you look at Rashi tries to reconcile all the systems to turn out the same, Ramban. And basically, in the time of the Ga'anim and the Rishayim, they tried to figure out what those Cheshbonos were. And they came up with different dates, and all of those dates passed. So according to Rashi, it was typically like 100 or so years ahead of where you were. So Rav Sadia Gaon put it in the 1000s, and Rashi put it in the 1100s, and the Ramban put it in the 1200s. The last of our Meforshim that tried to do that was the Malbim. The Malbim wrote in the 1900s, and the Malbim came up, or I'm sorry, the 1800s, 19th century, and the Malbim came up with 1920 as the most of Mashiach based on his understanding of the Sukkot. Now, there are 2 different issues I want to discuss here. Issue number one is what about the fact that Chazal pronounced a curse on those who try to calculate, Chashvei Kates, those who try to figure out when Mashiach comes. Tipach Rucham, they should burst, they should be destroyed. So how could all these Rishonim be Mechashev the Kates? And it's so interesting. In one of the letters of the Rambam, somebody asked him about Mashiach and different calculations, so the Rambam quotes all the Mamari Chazal that you shouldn't do it, it's usher to do, it's no good to do, it's bad to do. Then it's but, you know, my father gave me a remez that he got from his so the Malbim tries to be miyashiv. The Malbim gives a teretz, but it's a very, when he has taiti, it's a very short teretz. The Malbim tries to say that the isra of a mechashiv case is only when the date that you've seen is a date that's long in the future. Because we tell people that the date of Mashiach is going to be 1,000 years from now, they're going to be tzibrachim, they're going to be heartbroken, they're going to give up hope, and they're not going to realize, of course, that even if there's an outside date, we can always accelerate Mashiach early. Mashiach, the Malbim says, when your date is in the near future, that's not going to be a problem. Now, Laniya Staiti, it's a very short terrace, because if anything, I think to come up with a close date is much worse, potentially, than a far date. Because a close date, the date comes and it goes, and it doesn't happen. What's going to happen to people? If anything, people might get more tzibrach. So the Malbim Svara only makes sense if you know your date is right. If you know your date is right, so no, I'm going to tell you in 10 years Mashiach is going to come. But if you really don't know, you're just giving pshatim in a pasuk, then pumfakir, it seems the sakana of a recent date is more dangerous than a long-term date. Now, the second kash I want to raise is, so what's the pshat? If Sadia Gaon comes up with a date, and actually, it's very interesting, it's very fascinating just in terms of pshat in the psukim, the ingenuity, because the psukim are so obscure, so difficult, and to be able to enter the psukim is just very, very fascinating, but all the dates are wrong. Sadia Gaon's date was wrong, Rashi's date is wrong, Ramban's date is wrong, Malbim's date is wrong. So what's the pshat? Do we say that the Rishonim made mistakes? So here you have to understand a very important thing about I might say, biblical prophecy in general. That is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu often gives nevuah that can be interpreted in many, many different ways. And which way it will happen is totally on the Sechus of Am Yisrael. So the emphasis is like this. The emphasis is, it's not the pshat, the Nevuah meant a particular date and not the other dates. The Nevuah was bedafka worded that each of those dates could have been a zaman of his Eiris of Geula, had we been worthy. So Rav Sadia Gaon's date was a possibility. And in fact, different Svarim try to do this, although I can't say I have a full grasp of it. They try to show that in each of those years, there were certain events that were Rurames to Geula. Sadia Gaon's dates, and Rashi's dates, and Ramban's dates, and even in the Malbim's dates. So the concept is this: when a Nevuah is obscure, it's not the pshat, it has a single meaning, and you're trying to find out what that meaning is. Rather, the meaning is indeterminate, and it will be chal based on the Zchus of Am Yisrael. A very good example in the Torah itself is the 400 years of the Bris Ben Absorim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham, your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now we know that they were only in Mitzrayim 210 years, and you count it from the birth of Yitzchak. But the Mefarshim tell us that the emes is it could have taken many, many different forms. It could have been counted from here. We would have stayed longer had we not been on the 49th level of Tuma. We should have stayed longer. I'll leave it to the emes, the Sfarim say. Had we stayed the extra 190 years in Mitzrayim, we would have been purified from our Zumama. But the problem was we would have hit the 50th level, so we couldn't have gone through that process. It's like chemotherapy that kills the patient. So what's Elamai? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Nevuah in a way that it could be fulfilled this way, or that way, or that way, or that way, and any of those ways would have been a valid key of the Nevuah. Okay, so you can look at the book Daniel, and again, I think what the Art Scroll does for Marshall is it does give you the different calculations. Obviously, Art Scroll does not take sides on when Mashiach is going to come. It's not going to tell you. But the Rishonim did use the book of Daniel as a mavteach for the Yemen of Geula. By the way, the well-known Masorah of Chazal, that the Bayis Sheni was 420 years. And this is actually very, very problematical in terms of secular history. Because it seems that the second temple was much longer. But it's Miyusad on a verse in Daniel. What was Machriach Chazal to come up with the 420 years was that the Pasuk says Hashem was gezer on Yerushalayim 70 weeks. 70 weeks. Now a week in that Pasuk means 7 years. It's called a Shavua. 70 weeks is 490 years. Chazal understood that Pasuk to mean that from the Chorban Bayis Rishon to the Chorban Bayis Sheni is 490 years. Since we know from the Chorban Bayis Rishon to the Binyan Bayis Sheni is 70 years, 490 minus 70 leaves you with 420. So it's the Cheshman of Seder Ha'olam, the Chazal's chronological work, is based on Shiviv Shavuos, our Nixon. So Daniel's a very, very interesting book in terms of going through the different Rishonim. In fact, the Yavar Ben Melech wrote literally three different Sfarim on Daniel. One is a Pasuk by Pasuk Pshat, like Rabbeinu writes generally. The other were trying to explain the messianic prophecies. He came up with another day around the Spanish Inquisition. That many, many people thought that was the Gog and Magog, and that would be the precursor to the oh, by the way, I want to correct something I said. I kept on using the words Nevuahs, Nevuahs, Nevuahs. Now let's think about that for a moment. Sefer Daniel, although there are so many predictions about the future, obviously, Daniel is not in the Sifrei Nevi'im. Daniel is in the Sifrei Kesuvim. And one might ask Akasha, what's the Nafkamina? And in fact, Gemara Megillah says Daniel was not a Navi. What's the pshat Daniel was not a Navi? I understand why Tehillim, let's say, so Tehillim are praises of Hashem. All right, but why would a Sefer like Daniel not be called Nevuah? Why would Daniel not be a Navi? He had future visions communicated to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The answer is this. This is a very important insight. What makes a Navi is not that he sees the future. Great, great tzaddikim can be seen as the future. What makes them a Navi is they are commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to communicate a message to Am Yisrael. The word Navi does not refer to what you see. Navi means nivsutasayim, what you communicate. And although Daniel was the repository of great, great future understandings, they were given to him as a private matana, so to speak, from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he was not commanded. He was allowed to write them down. He was not commanded to be mefarsing them. In fact, the Kodesh Baruch Hu's lashon was, write them down and keep them obscure, meaning don't explain them. So as a result, Daniel had tremendous havana, but Daniel was not a navi. And that's why his sefer is a kesuvah. Okay? Anything else?
How do you understand the idea of Pelagish?
Well, it's a big machlokas rishayim. How do you understand Pelagish? According to the Rambam, Pelagish. Now, again, first of all, there are two questions here. First of all, what is a Pelagish? That's what question number one. Question number two is, when is a Pelagish permitted and when is it forbidden? What is a Pelagish? We have a machlokas. One opinion says, a Pelagish is a woman that you have not married. It's a mistress. But she's not a prostitute. She has a permanent relationship with you, but she without marriage. That's a pelagish, an out of wedlock, steady relationship as opposed to a promiscuous one. According to another opinion, a pelagish is married, but it's an agreement not to have a kesuba. So there's a machlokas. Is a pelagish bali kedushin, or is a pelagish kedushin bali kesuba? Most rishonim say pasha pelagish is without kedushin. Let's go with that definition. But machlokas number two is, when is a pelagish butcher? So according to the Rambam, it is usher d'oraisa for a regular Jewish person to have relations with a woman outside of marriage. It's an usher d'oraisa, it's a love. It's not a chiyuv kares, there's no mamzeris, but it is a love. And the whole heter of pelagish is a special rule only for a melech. It is the prerogative of a melech. A melech has many, many prerogatives, many, many zechuyos, and pelagish is one of them. This is how we generally pass it. So unless somebody's a melech, we would consider pelagish to be usher d'oraisa. However, not to be totally honest, there is a minority of Rishonim, and an Achron like Rabbi Yaakov Emden often has kind of unusual das yochid opinions, who actually says that la halacha, a pelagish is mutter even to a hedgeite, and without getting into various scandals in New York and other places, there is a small segment of the religious community that has used Rabbi Yaakov Emden in some mater things that the Torah community would generally not permit. Let me point out a very simple thing, though. That is that even if a pelagish is mutter, certainly a pelagish that's a nida would not be mutter. So then you would have to create a whole scenario where a single woman would be going to the mikvah. That's what a pelagish is.
Yeah. So the rabbi said that it doesn't produce mamzerim, but.
See, Baruch Hashem, it does.
What is it? Does it produce equal inheritors?
Yeah, yes, it does. It does. A child born out of... First of all, even a mamzer inherits equally. Even if, God forbid, a woman were to commit adultery and have a child from a man that's married, the mamzer would inherit equally with the man's, the adulterer's other children and the like. So the Gabi inheritance, mamzeris, doesn't do anything negative. But a mamzer has prohibitions on who he can marry, who he or she can marry. But a child born out of wedlock, Baruch Hashem, has no disabilities at all. And let me tell you why that's an extremely important bit of information to know. Most people, let's say, who are chosrei b'tshuva, good, their parents were not living out of wedlock in a sense the way we normally understand it. But keep in mind that if they didn't have a kosher marriage, they didn't have kosher edim, it's entirely possible that in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage is not a marriage. And if in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage are not a marriage, then they are born out of wedlock. That shouldn't scare anybody, because being born out of wedlock is not a problem. Two things. Hashem had rachamim because he saw, his work knew, that there would be a home movement of Balei Tshuva. One is that out of wedlock relationships don't produce mamzer. And the other is a relationship with a nida doesn't produce a mamzer. Now, in truth, that's an exception from the rule, because the normal rule of mamzer is any relationship which the punishment is kares produces mamzer. By that definition, a ben nida ought to be a mamzer. But imagine how many mamzerim there would be if there would be such a halacha. So, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, a child of a nida is not a mamzer, there is no problem. And the other thing that's uniquely, amazingly helpful is it actually is helpful in some cases to have parents who are not halachically married. And this is extremely helpful if you are, for example, a child born from a second marriage and your mom did not get a get from her first marriage. So you got a real problem here, theoretically, because if mom didn't get a get from her first marriage, she's still married to her first husband. So when she, even with a civil divorce, so when she marries husband number two, the child would be conceivably a mamzer, but we rely on a very well-known psaka of Rav Moshe Feinstein that says that if marriage number one did not have kosher eidim, it is therefore invalid, and an invalid marriage does not need a get. If it does not need a get, then marriage number two does not produce mamzerim. And if you're going to say, oh, but if you're invalidating marriage number one, you're also invalidating marriage number two, which may have been non-halachic, but that's okay, because invalidating marriage number two just means you're born out of wedlock. It's a lot better to be born out of wedlock than to be a mamzer. So this works out well. Now, not all the poskim agreed with Rav Moshe. The Emes says Rav Yosef b'Chatzchila was also machmer. There are poskim that say that even if a marriage is initially invalid, if they live together as husband and wife, and there are religious people who are aware of that, they become the witnesses, making it a marriage, which means, according to this psak, civil marriages, reform marriages, can morph into halachic marriages simply by them living together with other religious Jews knowing about it. This was the psak of Rav Henkin, was very chashuv of Pesach, and slightly older than Rav Moshe, and the like. But as they say, at least when it comes to mamzeris,
it requires a get.
It certainly requires a get. Yeah. But more than that, requiring a get is not as serious as the child being a mamzer. But regarding mamzeris, the Torah world is presently in Mako.
Does the pelagic you need to permit husband permission of the wife as like to allow the relationship?
You talking about pelagic?
Yeah.
Don't mention pelagic. It's an interesting question, because under Torah law, of course, a husband can marry two wives. And you don't need your wife's consent. But at least for Ashkenazim, since the 1100s, the 1000s, we have the famous takana of Rabbeinu Gershom. You all heard of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was very enormously great Gadol. He was the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe, or Rashi. And Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana for the Jews in Germany and Poland, Ashkenazic Jews, that there's a prohibition of polygamy. And so I'm not allowed to marry another wife. So the question becomes, and that's even if you give him permission. Now those who mazir Pilegesh say that since Pilegesh is without marriage, you're not marrying another wife, you're just having a mistress. And that's not having another wife, so you do not need the wife's permission. But I would not recommend it for showing pious concerns, if for no other reason. But besides that, let me just reemphasize that according to the Rambam, for a non-melech to have a pilegesh would in fact be a Torah prohibition. It wouldn't just be a showing pious type of problem. By the way, yes, I mentioned Ashkenazim. So two things about Rabbeinu Gershom's ban. There are actually two things he banned at the same time. Number one, he prohibited polygamy, taking another wife. And number two, he prohibited divorcing a woman against her will. Now, all you guys know from you're learning the eighth parak of Gittin, that the Torah basically allows me to throw a get in my wife's courtyard and all sorts of things, whether she likes it or not. That's all the law of the Torah, and even the Drabanan. But according to Rabbeinu Gershom, a man is not allowed to, unless she consents, generally speaking, we do not allow him to divorce her, right? So as a result, he can't marry another wife, and he cannot divorce her against her will, which means the question of aguna, when a woman is stuck because a man doesn't give her a get, can also apply to a man. If a woman refuses to receive a get, he could be stuck with the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Now, there are two things people say. A smart aleck always like to tell you, if you look in Rabbeinu Gershom's ban, it was only until the year 5000. It had an expiration date, and therefore it expired 774 years ago, and therefore it's mutter. Well, all of that is true, but the Beis Yosef informs us that the ban was extended by the later Chachamim, so it's in effect. But the second thing is that since Rabbeinu Gershom's jurisdiction, so to speak, was only among Ashkenazic communities, which is a broad category, really, in Germany, Poland, Lithuania, Russia, it did not embrace Sephardic communities, which are really North Africa, Syria, Iraq, those countries. So technically, Sephardim were allowed to marry two wives. When the Yemenites came to Israel, at first in the 1940s, there were some older people. I don't think there's anyone alive today, but old women brought multiple wives. But what Sephardim do to this very day is they have what you might call a privatization of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, meaning in the Sephardic civil, which is much longer than Ashkenazic civil, they actually say that the Chassan swears with a severe oath that he will not take another wife over this wife, and if he does so, he will immediately divorce the first wife with $1 million of ksuba. They put in a huge ksuba, which basically says, yeah, you're free to violate, you're free to marry another wife, but if you do so, you're going to have to pay my daughter, $2 million. So that's what you might call a privatization of the chemer of Gershom. Also, in 1948, the two chief, or 40, maybe 1950, the two chief rabbis, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, was Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog, and the Sephardic was Rabbi Zio. They made a joint takana, that Sephardim and Eretz Yisrael would be makabel, the chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom. And as a result, based on that takana, except for the grandfather clause, along with people who already had multiple wives, the Sephardim are bound by that takana. On the other hand, I saw a tshuva from Ravadia Yosef, who actually says that the Sephardic chief rabbi didn't have the power to give away the minhag of Sephardim to allow something. So he actually says the takana of his predecessor on Sephardim was batel u'mevutal. So there's even a machlokas. If Sephardim in Eretz Yisrael are bound by the takana. Again, Ravadia had a whole sheet of that. He felt that Sephardic rabbis were giving up too much authority to the Ashkenazic rabbis.
Yeah.
They had no right to just sell them out. So there's a big machlokas among Sephardim whether there is a takana in Eretz Yisrael that they cannot, that they're bound by chayav of their religion.
What is kavana?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. In fact, a friend of mine, not a friend of mine, but at least an acquaintance I know from Connecticut, wrote a very, very nice book in English. It's around 600 pages called Kavana. So you might want to look it up somewhere. So it goes through all different sources. And there are different forms of kavana. But the word kavana literally means direction, focus. The chaven is to direct my hand, right? Even if I want to, move something, I want to get something, so I have to be mechaven my yad, right? So kavana is direction, and it really means focused thoughts. The problem is that our minds are distracted constantly. Constantly seeing things, thinking of things, many, many different thoughts pass through our minds. We get distracted. We get distracted in everything. We get distracted in learning. If you're talking to me, my mind might be thinking about some problem I have or what I'm going to eat for dinner tonight. You might be thinking of something else, right? So one of the most difficult things for a human being to accomplish is to focus on a simple thing. Meditation is directed to that idea of learning to focus by shining it. So consequently, kavana is not a term that is muhad to prayer. Kavana is the general idea of focus. Focus without distraction, without static, without other things coming into your mind. Now, for tefillah, there's a special rule that in tefillah you have to be mechaven as you go. So I want to emphasize, people make a mistake. They sometimes think kavana is connected to understanding what you're saying. I mean, not really. It's true that if you understand what you're saying, you can focus better. And it's true there are other halachas that you're supposed to understand certain parts of that. For example, not that many, by the way. You have to understand the first pasuk of Shema, and you have to understand the first bracha in Shema Yisrael. The rest of Shema, even if you don't know what you're saying, you're yotzeh. But kavana would mean that you're focused, that you're speaking to Hashem, and you don't allow other things. Now again, for shteitzach, there's a very close relationship between knowing what you're saying and having kavana, but they are two different concepts. The kavana is not to be distracted by other thoughts. And that's for kavana. That's a very, very difficult thing. Rabbi Kaplan, Aleph HaShalom, was a big proponent of kosher forms of meditation. He wrote three books on meditation. Jewish meditation, meditation in the Bible, and meditation in the Kabbalah. The library here, if you find anything in the library here, probably has at least one of those books. I'm not sure which one, but I'm sure one of the three is up there. Now, Rabbi Kaplan claimed a lot of benefits to meditation. He claimed that meditation was the main activity in the Nevi'im schools. We read in Tanakh, there was a group of people called B'nai HaNevi'im. Now, B'nai HaNevi'im means the children of the prophets, but that means the students of the prophets, which implied there were schools you went to learn prophecy. But how can you learn prophecy? Prophecy is a gift from Hashem, the Rambam says. I mean, no matter what your techniques, you know, you're not going to automatically be a prophet. So the Rambam explains that's true. A lot of people who graduated maybe didn't get the job of being a prophet. But the Rambam says, in addition to Hashem giving you gifts, there are techniques that make you receptive to receive the word. And Rabbi Kaplan claimed primarily there were different techniques of advanced meditation in which if you can get rid of the distraction, you could receive the divine light. So he claimed that was Hachana from Nevuah. He also said that when the Mishneh Brachos tells us that the Hasidim are Rishayna, the early pious people, these are not the Baal Shem Tovs, but much earlier, they used to spend an hour before davening, and then they would daven an hour and an hour after davening. He connected that to meditative states to be able to get into davening. So he claims that the notion of focused meditation is a very, very long Messiah in Yisrael. And I can't necessarily judge it historically, but there's no question that whether you call it, really what you call it doesn't make a difference, but certainly taking time before tefillah to kind of focus the thoughts, calm yourself down, not to be agitated, not to be nervous, is the way that you can focus your thought. Now there's an interesting machlokas in my contemporary Dovim, Rabbanim, Hasidish Rebbes, about pacing. There are some rabbis who actually take the position that, at least in their own avodah, it's better to daven very quickly than very slowly. They actually daven, there are great Hasidic rabbis who daven the Shemoneh Esrei about 3 minutes because they feel they can have this intense, focused concentration if they kind of stretch out the words. So, they stretch out the words, their mind is going to wander. So there is a shita, better to daven quick than daven slow. Others say you got it slow, you can concentrate, etc. Certainly one of the problems we have when you go to yeshiva is slower than the shul of Baba Batra. Certainly when you go back to America, the pace in virtually every shul is going to be very, very difficult. And what's worse is, I notice if you ever have to daven for the Yomim, the fast shul, very, very, very uncomfortable, because in addition to having to daven fast, which you can do. Theoretically, it's possible to be focused and not intense. But when you're nervous that somebody's going to be yelling at you, that creates a lot of anxiety. That shoots out kavanah. What destroys kavanah is the sense of somebody breathing down your back. So the whole shayla and halacha, should that potter me from tefillah b'tzibur? If my only choice, because I don't have a million choices in most places in America, if my only choice is super fast minyan, or davening the yechidas. So it's an interesting shayla. Certainly, you should go to the minyan at least to hear Kaddish, Kedusha, Kriya Tiferet. That doesn't touch you. But the question is, the etzem tefila, some would say it's better to not have hands. Again, join the show. Yeah, join the show for Kaddish Kedusha, Orcha Red, and Kriya Sefer. In fact, you've heard many of you don't understand that. That's interesting. Not so much among the listeners. Many of you see even the Chazanish often did. The Chazanish often did this. The Chazanish often davened the Yechidus, and he would join. There was actually a minion in his house. He didn't have a minion in his house. And he would, like, come in different nights. So there is, again, you have to know. I mean, many people say that Bizman Azar, we don't have such great Kavanah anyway, even if we're by ourselves. So we really shouldn't use our need for Kavanah to separate from the Sibor. But there are times in which, I think the Chazon Ish's ace actually was to assert to Bachor that twice a week he could take off to have his Yisraelis as the Kavanah, and the rest of the time he should be the Sibor, even if it compromises his Kavanah. But you should talk to your rabbi about it. The Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is Gufa condition. I mean, what's the Gezerah? The Gezerah is there's maybe multiple Gezerahs. If you do X, you'll get X. If you do Y, you'll get Y. Meaning to say, the Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is not a Gezerah Mukhlat in the sense that no matter what you do, it's a Gezerah that's Mukhushar to a certain Darga of Hishtavos, which of course creates a total unknown equation. Now, you're right, the Chavis HaLavavis is not mashma. The Chavis HaLavavis is mashma. You're going to get what you're going to get. How will Hashem cheshben ois if you don't do the shtaglis? How is it going to work? I don't know. But the Chavis HaLavavis is mashma. You're going to get what you're going to get. But the swarm that say you could be mopsed it, it's not really, it's not a mass. It's based on the fact that the etzem Gezerah itself is along a range of infinite possibilities. Meaning that the Shbarach Hu cheshbens the amount of Hishtadlus, and the Parnasa is Mekusher to that amount of...
Where's the Mekusher?
I have to see what the Mekusher is. I mean, it's brought down in many places. I would check, maybe Rick Destin may say this.
It's also, that's a similar thing applies to the Gezerah, 40 days before you fly. It also is decided for the Gezerah.
Well, there you see the Farish in the Gemara. That's you don't even need a Rodessah. There you see the Farish in the Gemara that you could be Matzah. The Gemara says you're allowed to make a Shidduch even in the 9 days, because, or Cholamayit, because Shema Yukadmenu Acher, maybe somebody through Tefillah will take away your Bashit. So there you see for a Dabra Pashit that one could be mopsed his b'sher either by a lack of schlis, or even if not a lack of schlis, somebody else has an extra schlis of a kayach of tefila. So there you have a perish of that. And people just ask this type of, I don't have my b'sher. He said, you met your b'sher 5 years ago, you didn't want to go out with him, or you didn't want to continue with him. So it's probably not the case that everybody marries that particular one that was new, sir. But that doesn't mean as a good worker then gives you a tachlis, and it can work in the second stage as well. It's not like a bigger shame.
Or even. What is a talmud chacham?
Well, you know, the Ramah says, talmud chacham has a lot of privileges in it. It doesn't have to pay taxes, all sorts of things. Although the IRS, or even the Israeli taxing authority, the Hamas, has not accepted that yet. But the Ramah says on that, nobody's a Talmud Chacham today, so Talmud Chacham have to pay their taxes. But the definition of a Talmud Chacham, well, again, like everything else, we throw around the words today. But Chaim Leiser once said, Chaim Leiser, would get letters from all over the world, and the letters would have many, many titles. Of course, he was deserving of the titles. Rabbi Shol Kol Ben Abayla, he was given the greatest titles. But he would laugh, in his Anava, he would laugh and he would say, reminded him, if you remember the Weimar Republic before World War II, after World War I, inflation was saying that's really how the Nazis got into power. the inflation was so excessive that you have to use a billion marks to buy a loaf of bread. You may have seen the news, we have a picture of people with wheelbarrows and wheelbarrows of money to get a piece of bread. So Chaim Meisher says the inflation of titles in the Torah world, which reminded him of the inflation for bread in Germany, where, you know, a person who was a rab is now a rab again, and the person who was a gain is a gain. You know, everything is of course, in Chaim Meisher's case, that was, I would have to say, false modesty, but in some ways, everything is in inflation today. Here you have a guy in Shiva, you know, who's been learning Gemara for 2 years, he gets engaged, Baruch Hashem, so we might say, fine Talmud Chacham, which, again, the Mitzvah saying will be a fine Talmud Chacham, and like. But the Ramah says, the definition of a Talmud Chacham is a big definition, it's a hard definition. It's someone that you can ask him anywhere in the shop, and he will be able to explain it to you. And even as, including Maseches Kala. Maseches Kala is not even part of the regular Shas. It's the Maseches, the small Maseches. They're like appendix Maseches and the like. So the Chazanish explains what that means is, not just if you translate a line of Gemara, but it means in any Sugya Shas, he could give you the Iker, Gemara, and the Rishon. The Iker, it doesn't mean, I mean, only the great, greatest Gedolim are holding every sugya all the time. But he has to be able to address it, right? So now that's the objective definition. Now, the truth of the matter is, in some ways, inflation is justifiable in the sense that when the door gets weaker and weaker, so you need to give chizuk to people. So if people finish a lot of the sectors and learn a lot of Gemara, you know, they should get some recognition for their accomplishments. But a Talmud Chacham, according to the Ramah's definition, is you could ask him, I think the lesson is Raiv Sugya Sashas, and he's able to be Meshiv. Some have given a more limited definition. They have said he's able to be Meshiv in three Siddharim of Shas. What are the three Siddharim of Shas? As you would guess, Nashim, Nezikin, Moed. Because maybe Zerayim, Kachim, Taros, although Zerayim is very Nogaya today in Eretz Yisrael, but for most of the Golos, it was not Nogaya to Maisa. So we'll let him off the hook for Shabbat because of Tyrus, but at least Nashim Nezikin, and he should know. Now, one other thing I want to say about the Talmud Chacham, and that is, it's very, very interesting that literally, what is the translation of the Talmud Chacham? The Talmud Chacham, actually, it's an ambiguous translation. It could mean student of the wise, or it could mean a wise student. But either way, you'll notice that we call the person a Talmud. Now, you might say, I could say, for example, Rebbe Yashiv was the greatest Talmud Chacham of the generation. Or Rebbe Yosef, whoever, not picking Gedolim, but whoever you want to pick as your God. But it's funny, Talmud Chacham? Talmud? So the Bali Musar say, beautiful voice, saying that the true son of godless and Torah is, no matter how much you know, you still not. You're still a Talmud. You still want to keep on going. Because when you think, I know it already, then by definition, you haven't reached that much greater. So the word Talmud Chacham is a very extraordinary term, because it suggests that the Iker thing that's Koveya Godless in Torah is the She'ifa, the desire to keep on going. That's why I remember, what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that why are Talmud Chachamim called fish? Because of fish. So it mentions that a fish lives in water. A fish is surrounded by water. But when it's raining, and it looks like drops of water are hitting, the fish swim up to the top to take in a little more water. Now, the truth is, they think it's worms. Well, okay, but it looks, at least visually, it looks like they're going up to the water. So too, a Talmud Chacham is surrounded with Torah. But he hears another voice, another Ha'orah, another Daher. He rushes. That's what they say. Archibald got a publicity picture was. They really could have used this in advertising. Rebbe Yashiv was looking at the Hebrew Shabbos, you know, the Archibald Hebrew version. And he was looking at the picture. We have plenty of people who use our department. Now, what was he looking at? And here you have a person he'd been learning, you know, almost 100 years. Maybe he was learning 100 years, more for 100 years. and looking at the ice scroll, you know, what is he looking at? You know, even in the second, they don't let you look at the ice scroll, right? But yes, you're looking, maybe the human they'll let you look at. But the answer is, this is Mamish the example. You know, the guys who write the art scroll are Kachuba Kaol people who have done research and they've looked up Marma Kamas. So Rabbi Lezer think, maybe I'll get something new. Amazing thing. Like the fish. Maybe just a little lower here. I'll learn from somebody who's 75 years, you know, younger than me. Maybe he came up with something. I'll just end with this, Rabbi Lezer Silver. He was a great Gadol. He came from Europe, and he came to America in 1920, so he was in America before World War II, and in fact, he was very influential in helping Jews out of the Holocaust and the like. His first shteller was in a New England town. I don't want to mention it, it's just a much part of the town, and he was relatively young, and he was fired from the rabbinate in the 1920s. And the reason he was fired was he was spending night times in the synagogue learning Gemara, and they thought he was wasting electricity. They didn't want a rabbi who was wasting electricity. So when he said, well, you know, I'm learning, they said, ah, that's the whole point. You know, we want a rabbi who finished his education. You're learning, you're getting your degree at our expense? Get out of here. You know, we want somebody who knows his stuff. You know, so what can I tell you? This, the Musa that, you know, you learn Torah and then you're finished and then you graduate is something that Baruch Hashem, I think, is so foreign to all of us that we understand that one keeps on going. So there's a Hashem, which will be saying that we keep on going. And as Rabbi Eisen said, we too are in the army. People debate, I don't see the guys in the army. The other says, we are in the army and we should feel that we're in the army. Because the Avodas Hashem is the Torah that you learn. Is bringing Siyata Mishmaya and Bracha to Israel. Take it very, very seriously. The same way that a military soldier cannot abandon his post. It's very, very serious. So too, a Ben Torah has to realize not to abandon post. That's why this small gesture of the every moment as she was extending this man at least by a few days. Some places, some Hasidic places, have literally canceled Ben Esmanim. Now, if you ask, why don't we cancel Ben Esmanim? So, this is a difficult shikul, meaning there is a logical reason that there ought not to be a Ben Esmanim at all. But you also have to look at the long-term consequences. There's not going to be a Ben Esmanim at all. El Esmanim, you know, people will be exhausted, tired. So, in a sense, you have to weigh every Rosh Hashiva has to weigh the qualitative benefits in learning by giving people a break versus the sacrifice in quantity. And me, Yemer, he says what's going to be a bigger zechus? Is it a bigger zechus that people can learn with more hislavos, or is it a bigger zechus to learn without interrupting? But these are difficult shikulim, and different rabban and different Rosh Hashivas have come out of different ways, but for Steinman, who's kind of the level that you're following, seems to indicate that we should try to compromise by both extending his mind a little bit but also still giving a famous mind. But still, famous mind doesn't mean you have to be part of it. You know, you are allowed to learn famous mind. It's not us to learn. And certainly, whatever a person is able to do, consistent with their needs for rest and relaxation, which is a need, one should try to do it. But again, we do need this explicit prayer in the time of great. Anyway, I'm sorry, I can't stay. I would love to stay. I just want to wish everyone a tremendous Yashikaya. I hope you give you much, much blessings.